The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Tiffany Hall, the CIO and Director of Technology at Cancer Research UK. Thanks for doing this anyway, Tiffany. Like I was saying just before we started recording there, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's I've actually been really wanting to talk to someone kind of with your background and experiences. And obviously we'll cover that. But before we do, welcome and thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
It's really interesting because I've actually been, well, I think it was a few months ago towards the start of the year, I was doing a lot of work with the CDOs. So we had a couple of CDOs on the show and we were kind of building this discussion about that role in particular. I think typically because it's quite a new role as far as the C-suite goes, relatively new, should I say. And it's been interesting to see like the development and like the place for something like that. I always find it interesting because I talk to various people with the C-suites like yourself, and everyone tends to have like a slightly different definition or, you know, their take on their role. And I think that that's natural depending on like who you're working for. You know, whereas you, for instance, you've held C-level roles at a few different companies. So I thought it might be interesting to get your kind of take on it. But, is it important, I suppose, to have like a clear distinction for the responsibilities and the requirements for a CIO? Or do you feel as though it needs to be a little bit more flexible on that kind of distinction?
I'm in the camp that thinks it needs to be fairly flexible and that it will naturally vary across different organisations. For Cancer Research UK, where I am now, I'm the first CIO they've had. There previously wasn't a technology person on the board. And so I've got quite a great opportunity to kind of shape that up into what I want it to be. And I'm sure a different person in the role with different skill set might make something that was a slightly different shape. And that would be fine. So I think what's interesting around board levels is that at this kind of stage of people's careers, the flexibility allows you to play to people's strengths. So, for example, in an organization where you had a chief marketing officer, if they were a very technically adept and aware one, then the role of the CIO into the marketing function would be less than if that CMO was less in that space. As you mentioned, the CDO, I think that data is now becoming such a key part of all of our C-suite roles that if you do have a CDO, they're going to find themselves having to work, you know, collaboratively right across the organisation, across their colleagues. We don't have a CDO, and for us, our data is a very interesting space for us at the moment. As with any other fundraising organisation, we have interesting data insights that's associated with what our supporters are doing, so how much money they're giving us, whether they come back, whether they drop out of their user journey, and that's all very much in the sort of digital sphere. But then we have huge data potential around the ability to use data to analyse data to actually research about cancer and cure cancer. So that's a very exciting area for us. And that really doesn't sit with me. That sits with our research director, because it needs to sit with people who understand the nature of clinical trials and understand the nature of cancer, which is really not my thing. so data is quite a spread function for us.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, to the CDOs that I spoke with, it's very much become like this cultural shift. And I think that's a part of the thing, what they're trying to implement from a position of leadership is that kind of cultural shift and attitude towards data. But, you know, like you say, you don't have one. And I still think that there's the importance of data now. And I can imagine, as you were alluding to before, about cancer research, for example, any charitable organization where they raise funds, that, you know, you have to shift that culture towards the appreciation and the understanding of data and the importance of it, you know, without going into, you know, the GDPR that happened in May, which is, you know, if I can avoid talking about it, I will. You know, it's obviously at the forefront of where everyone's thinking it. So I can imagine that a CIO has kind of always been the case, but I'd be interested to see whether you think that that sense and responsibility towards data has been heightened in recent years and what, you know, what your kind of take is on that.
I think it has been heightened in recent years, and I think the complexity of what's possible with big data lakes and the use of analytics and algorithms, machine learning, AI, we could go on forever, means that it's a much more complex and a much more exciting space. As we've touched on, it doesn't always sit under the CIO. It can sit in a number of places. I just wanted to go back to one of your earlier comments about the need for the organisation to understand the importance of data. One of the things about us being a deeply scientific research organisation is that it's actually an incredibly data-driven place. Data and the need for decisions to be evidence-based is actually really deep within the DNA of Cancer Research UK. And when I started here just over a year ago, finding the extent to which that understanding of the importance of data had permeated right through into the GDPR program was really impressive. I mean, I couldn't believe the extent to which a year ago people right through the organization in every department knew about GDPR, knew what was coming, knew we needed to do stuff about it. It was incredible, and we had a very positive review during our implementation. I think we were kind of quite ahead of the curve in terms of the charity sector in getting our act together, which was great.
And I mean, incredible balancing act, you know, to work for a company as large as who you're working for, and to be able to be consistent with that messaging must be kind of quite the operation for something like that. So, you know, it has to be almost the foundations of, you know, the way that you kind of articulate important points across the organization. Those foundations clearly need to be in place for something to be as effective and as efficient and to be grasped as quickly as it was. So
that very much that precedes me, and it came actually from our CEO who understood it in some depth quite quickly and understood that, notwithstanding, you know, the changes in the legislation and the increase in fines that were possible and so on, that our supporters need to trust us with their data or they will stop giving us money, you know. So it's very it's really crucial to us, and he our CEO, he really kind of got that and imbued that into the whole organization quite quickly. But as you said, let's perhaps not spend the whole conversation talking about GDPR.
Yeah, we'll save our listeners the I've had enough of those, and I think that I'll probably get text messages if we release this saying again ? If I was to talk too much about GDPR. But from a CIO's perspective as well, the other area is clearly technology. And, you know, for me, I'm not the most technical person in the world, but I'm one of those people that's like fascinated by everything to do with technology. You know, I'm interested, I keep up to date with everything to do with technology. I'm a bit of a nerd, I suppose, from that perspective. You know, with this CIO role, it, like you say, it touches so many different departments. Technology clearly being, one of them. For you to be productive and progressive in the CIO role, how important is it that you kind of keep up to date on the latest and greatest and have, you know, kind of a deep understanding of technology? And I suppose this is probably a good opportunity to ask about your kind of background a little bit as well, and whether you know, technology has always been kind of a core part of, you know, your skill set really, or your interests at least.
Yes, it has been. So I did physics as far as A level, but not beyond. And I actually sort of for physics, maths, and English, I was very torn between the roots, between sort of words and numbers, if you like. But ended up doing a maths degree with a computing option. I spent some time coming up through the traditional ranks of a computer programmer up to project manager type stuff, and that was in an oil company. And then I moved to the BBC, and I became head of IT for BBC News at about the time that News had realised that IT was not going to be just about, you know, email and finance systems, that coming off videotape and radiotape and editing on computers, that was back when it was. So I reported, instead of into finance, I reported into the guy that ran all the production technology, the cameras, the graphics, the satellite trucks, the uplinks and so on, where the engineers, you know, thought that my lack of broadcast engineering and physics knowledge was a bit of a joke, but they got over that pretty soon. And I eventually ended up running the whole sort of technology program for BBC News. Later did a CIO role, later did roles with Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. So I've always loved, I am a bit of a geek. I love gadgets, love seeing tech. So that's not kind of a problem for me. And here at CRUK, we have a little tech innovation team, very kind of lean, just, you know, at the moment, a couple of people are intern. And they horizon scan, they look at what's happening, they look for the trends, and we plug that into our broader strategy work with the leadership team. And ideas can come from anywhere, not just from them, of course, but they often curate those, sort of manage those. And I love watching what they're up to. It's great. It's one of my favourite things.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, with regards to the kind of charitable sector as well, I can imagine it being, like, really compelling with regards to the opportunity, because I think the presence of technology and the potential impact that it can have in charity specifically, I think the opportunities are more compelling than they've ever been. You know, I actually worked for a startup in London called Touch Surgery, and they, you know, the innovation there is to give access to best practices of surgery on a global scale using, you know, AR, you know, apps, so that people can literally keep up to date regardless of what country you're in, you know, on the latest and greatest tech. So that's like a fascinating project, and that was just one of them. You know, there was a friend of mine who I met, and he was working on out of the eye hospital over there in Old Street, and he was working on using an app for cataracts. And, you know, these are really incredible opportunities that technology's brought to, you know, they were obviously talking specifically about third world, but regardless, you know, it's truly amazing how much technology can innovate. And, you know, obviously with cancer, I'm, you know, very hopeful that, you know, it's really going to influence on a massive scale, even just from an information perspective. So it's got to be, I'm sure when you started the role, you probably went, your mind was going crazy on like the potential that, you know, technology could bring to, you know, cancer research.
Oh yeah, it's incredibly exciting, and there's lots already going on. I mean, you mentioned augmented reality with virtual reality. My team did some virtual reality showing some of our research institutes to help inspire our supporters. But much more excitingly, really, we've got scientists at the moment using virtual reality headsets to examine the behaviour of cancer genes, because examining them in a three-dimensional world is triggering new ideas. And what's also exciting is that the research scientists who are working on that, there's one of ours here in the UK, but then there's somebody on the West Coast, and I think it's the East Coast of the States, I'm not sure, but the three of them are working together in a virtual environment, looking at what cancer's doing. I mean, that's just fabulous. We built a smartphone app for the doctors who work on lung cancer, which we did jointly with the British Thoracic Society, and that's a whole sort of decision tree kind of app for them to help do some of their mathematical calculations quite quickly and take them through the sort of next steps and logic of what they need to look at next. So it's a sort of pulmonary nodule risk app. So that, I mean, it just goes on and on. I think the Australians are leading the way on skin cancer, as you'd expect, and that's around using image scanning and image recognition to identify skin cancers faster, better, more cheaply than a doctor can. There's quite a lot of interesting ethical stuff around the use of technology when it comes to medical treatment, because who owns the decision of the machine has aided, you know, has made the machine can't make the decision, and the technology has to provide information that allows the clinician to make a judgment. It's a bit like the sort of the medical equivalent of VAR, you know, the ref still has to make the decision. So it's a very, very exciting world out there at the moment. It really is.
It's great.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And like you say, I think it's the information that's the key. And I think that argument, I've heard that before about, like, at the end of the day, someone has to make the decisions. But it's being better informed. And that's, at the end of the day, is what we're trying to achieve here. You know, better research, better source of information, so we can make better decisions. I mean, essentially, that's the core of it. And hopefully that's what, you know, technology is able to bring to something like cancer. I think everyone has a personal experience with someone who's been affected by cancer. So it's fascinating. And I'd be like you, I'd very much be looking over that team's shoulder and being like, right, so what's going on today then, guy? I wouldn't get much done, to be honest, if I was there. I'd just be seeing what they're messing around with this week.
Yes, it'd be very easy to get sucked into that and not worry about whether or not, you know, the IT network was down or viruses were in or whatever. The sort of more mundane operational stuff still needs a bit of attention occasionally, not just the fun new funky stuff.
I mean, security as well. You know, I mean, everything that you kind of mentioned and I can think of today as well, it must affect you in some way. So, I mean, how do you even go about kind of structuring your day? I mean, maybe this is like a question as well that I personally have, is about the distinction between, you know, the management really and leadership. You know, the C-level roles clearly fall under that kind of leadership category. You know, there's so much there that, especially for a CIO, that you have to deal with and has to be on your radar. I can't imagine what your diary looks like, which I suppose gives me a greater appreciation for taking the time with me today. But, you know, how do you manage that? How do you manage that kind of workload when there is so much to go at and so many decisions that have to be made? You know, how do you even approach kind of structuring your days or your weeks?
So there is a risk, and I've certainly been susceptible to it, that actually your diary ends up being managed and controlled by other people, the people who've asked for your time. I mean, obviously there are regular board meetings, regular operational meetings, and making sure there's enough time for strategy, for vision, for inspiring your team, encouraging them, coaching them, networking, understanding your stakeholders, that there is a risk that can get neglected. And one of the things that myself and my senior leadership team have just been working on recently is focusing in what are our five or six big things that are our highest priority. And we've done that, and we've communicated that to the broader technology team. And the challenge that one of them said to me a couple of days ago was, okay, now have a look at your diary. And to what extent is your time being spent on those things? And very quickly one realizes that it's easy to not spend enough time on the bigger picture things and to get sucked into lower level. So it's definitely something to kind of guard against. So I think I've got a little bit to do in that space at the moment, having had that challenge from one of the team a couple of days ago. We've got an interesting situation at the moment as well with Cancer Research UK, that our CEO has left a couple of weeks ago, and our new CEO, she doesn't start for another couple of months. So we're in a slight sort of limbo where all of the board are really being expected to kind of step up a bit in terms of leading the organisation more broadly while we're in that gap between the two. So that's also another kind of added dimension on my diary at the moment. But it's you're right to ask the question. It is really hard to make sure you're spending your time on the right things, and there never seems to be enough time.
That's the difficult bit without having the clear distinction, because what is, how do you prioritize? You know, I have the same kind of issues myself, not on the scale that you're working at, of course, not nowhere near as big as an organization, but I have those things as well. It's like, well, how do I kind of prioritize my time, I suppose. And obviously without having that kind of clear distinction makes it more difficult potentially. But so it's almost a catch-22, because you need that flexibility without having like a super defined set of responsibilities, but at the same time you have to be able to prioritise.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I find quite useful, quite effective, is to use the power of hot desking to get myself near to the current kind of hotspots or current worries without actually then having to put something in the diary. So if I know that one of my leadership team is having a particularly challenging time or an extra pressure of work or whatever, I'll tend to go and sit near them and their team in between meetings. I mean, obviously, as all of us, we're in meetings a lot of the time, but for those gaps in between, because that then creates the serendipitous moments for them or their team to just say, oh, by the way, you know, as you're here. It's quite interesting the number of conversations, really useful conversations, I will get into that give me a sense of, you know, where problems might be brewing or where opportunities and exciting things might be happening. They very often happen from those sort of, yeah, as I say, serendipitous, almost water cooler kind of moments, and trying to create those in the right place in the organisation is actually relatively easy to do. It's something I did quite a lot when I was at the BBC, where we roved around the organisation quite a lot from a sort of physical point of view. Here I have the luxury that almost all of my team, I think all but two, are in the same building. They're in the same city or country. I mean, it's fantastic. So that's really great, and I love taking advantage of that by moving myself around the building a fair bit.
Yeah, I actually second that, because I think at one point, and I worked on the Hyperloop project for a while, which I don't know.
The which project, sorry?
The Hyperloop. You know that one with Elon Musk? It's like, it predated his Boring Company project, but it was a similar kind of concept, you know, fast train, you know, whatever, right? And they kind of crowdfunded that project in a way where it was not crowdfunded financially, but crowdfunded to grow the team. So you'd kind of work and build up your equity stake in the company. And that's the way that they did it. And what that meant was that everyone was remote. So there wasn't actually a brick and mortar anywhere in the world.
Well, it
was
great.
Everyone was completely remote, and you kind of worked your time. And yeah, it was really interesting to see that kind of dynamic. And obviously I was a part of that, a small part of that, but, and that kind of worked for that, but there was always that, well, we're not all working fully on this project. We're all kind of remote. There was still that substance missing that maybe I'm kind of reverting my views on, to where I do think that it's important to have that kind of face-to-face contact. And I think the one part of the workplace is that we do have the ability to still get things done remotely, but I'm still one who thinks, you know, it's massively important to have that kind of human contact, that face-to-face, to get and to be able to articulate points and be at most effective. I think there's still always going to be a need for that. And I was a person who thought that, you know, it's probably a dying art, but after I've had more managerial and leadership responsibilities, I think you have a different perspective on how helpful it can be to have people in the same place.
Yeah, it is. I think, you know, realistically, there are organisations where that simply isn't possible, and you have to make the remote working tools work as best you can, and recognizing how powerful it is to have face to face. I mean, I would add to that that the difference between a video call and an audio call is not to be underestimated. We had a very interesting situation in the BBC where a member of one team, not my team, moved to Bristol and worked from there, from the BBC's offices there. And when she started joining the team meetings by a video link rather than just an audio link, the sense of teamness and connection was palpably different. Her line manager was commenting that after they started using video conferencing, that when Jane came to London for their meetings, they all felt as if they'd seen her just the other day. You know, it felt there was a sense of kind of continuity and connection that was far greater than when she'd just been on the phone. But yes, face-to-face stuff is much better and much preferable. It's just not always possible. With CRUK, we're relocating in 15, 16 months' time to Stratford-on-Avon, Stratford East London. And for some people, the extra commute is going to mean that they will be looking to do more remote working. And as I say, for many people in the charity, they have been accustomed to a distributed workforce, but for a lot of people, that'll be a bit newer. So we're looking at improving our skills in that space, improving our ability to chair meetings when not everybody's in the room, improving line managers' ability to, you know, manage by results rather than presenteeism. So it's a definite area of sort of hot topic for us at the moment within the charity.
And to that point as well, I wanted to mention, I feel like I definitely wanted to take it, and I sent it over to you in my notes as well, about, you know, the ability to get and build more of a diverse and have a greater presence in the kind of underrepresented groups. I think some people have mentioned it to me that they do believe that this kind of the remote working could be potentially something that can help impact that. But it's clearly not the answer to everything. But is it something that, you know, you have, or whether, you know, you have had conversations internally or previous organisations, I can imagine?
Yeah, I mean, certainly diversity of the workforce is something I'm very much in the conversations with here and in previous roles, not perhaps so much in the context of remote working tools, sometimes in the context of other types of tools, for example, for people with disabilities. The BBC was very sort of strong on that in terms of, you know, screen readers for blind people and so on. I had two blind people in my team at one stage. So technology's role in that capacity was very important. I think you're right, though, in other forms of diversity. So let's say it's people with caring responsibilities, whether that's, you know, children or parents or whatever, the ability to work at more varied hours and to do some of that remotely, yes, helps with that part of the workforce. I think looking at the diversity agenda more broadly, there's a lot of concern, of course, in industry around the underrepresentation of women in technical roles, whether that's everything from kind of, you know, aerospace engineers and construction, you know, civil engineers through to IT. And there's been a lot of work done around best practice in job specification, recruitment, retention, unconscious bias. There's a very good initiative called the Tech Talent Charter, which was launched by the Digital Skills Minister, Matt Hancock, who I think has now got health. And that is a consortium of employers looking to share best practice around initially diversity. They're focusing in on gender, but I think will go broader in due course. For us here at Cancer Research UK, we in charity sector is very female, and so I'm lucky enough that that has expanded over into the technology team. So in technology, we're 48% female. And the rest of the charity, as well as being very female, is very white, if I'm honest. And again, my team is the BAME representation is much higher in technology than the rest of the charity. But right through everywhere, the thing we, I think, are the weakest at is social mobility. And we're making sort of active steps in that space at the moment. We're one of the first charities to pay our interns. So this summer's intake that just started, gosh, a couple of days ago, I think, they were paying them for the first time. And although other many organisations, of course, have been paying interns for a while in the charity sector, and I think media as well, it's been a bit slower. And we're really excited that that will help with the diversity, the mix of people.
Leave it here. I think we've pretty much covered everything anyway. I think you nicely rounded it up there with the finish on the adversity. So that should be plenty. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.